The next case on the court's docket is in the matter of apparel rights as to DJM, a minor. Case 65659. Okay, Ms. Gilbert, will you be arguing this matter?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, Mr. George and I will both be
arguing. Okay, you'll split your time then. All right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the Court. Jacqueline Gilbert on behalf of Appellant Jessica W., the mother in this case. Also appearing is John George on behalf of Appellant Damu M., or the father in this case. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I will address the due process legal issues and application to the mother. Mr. George will be addressing the application to the father. We ask this Court to reverse the order terminating parental rights for the following reasons. Jessica's due process rights were violated by one, ineffective assistance of counsel, and lack of appropriate notice of the requirements for reunification. Further, even without a due process violation, there was lack of clear and convincing evidence to support the best interests of child and parental fault.
Can I just get right to the point with you?
Sure.
You're not arguing that in these cases there's an actual right to counsel. So I'm curious to get to your argument. I'm anxious to get to your argument why there would be a right to effective assistance of counsel when you're not entitled to counsel in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, partly this goes to the problem is that in the record, for example, here, there is no findings one way or the other as to why counsel was appointed. What we have in Nevada...
That's a discretionary matter with the judge evaluating a whole number of circumstances.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I understand that. And we do actually concede that there is no right under the 14th Amendment in the United States Constitution. And unfortunately, we do not argue here under the Nevada Constitution. What we're saying is that oftentimes the court uses its discretion, and we don't know why. And this court doesn't know why the district court exercises this discretion to appoint counsel for any number of reasons. What we are asking is there be a presumption that without anything else in the record or evidence to the contrary, that appointment of counsel was for purposes of due process concerns by the district court. Partly that is to avoid this court from having to become a de facto fact finder under Matthews v. Eldridge. In other words, if there's no findings in the record, then when somebody does raise ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal, then what they're doing is asking this court to go back, do a post hoc analysis of what the judge might have been thinking back when counsel was appointed. And that isn't the purpose of this court. It's the purpose of the district court. And where there's no evidence to the contrary in the record, we would simply ask for a presumption. So it takes away the fact-finding in this court. It also helps, to a certain extent, it doesn't shift any burdens at trial. In other words, the trial's going to be the same. The state's going to have to prove by clear and convincing evidence any rebuttable presumptions that exist will have to be overcome by the parents in the case, the defendants in the case. So it doesn't shift any burden at trial. It changes review, is what it does, essentially. What it does do, and what the state's job always is to make sure that whatever proceedings happen are fair. That's essentially always the state's job because it represents the people of the state and the court itself, the proceedings in the court itself. So we simply ask for a presumption under that case. The second thing that we have asked for is for this court to consider adopting the Geist standard that was set forth in Oregon of fundamental fairness versus the Strickland analysis when independent assistance of counsel does apply. And part of the reason is they seem very similar. The two tests appear very similar on their surface, Strickland being a review of performance under reasonable counsel, and would there be a difference or a prejudice and a change, would the outcome have been different? Under Geist, we're looking, were the proceedings fundamentally fair, and would the result have been different with effective assistance? So they seem almost the same. The difference is that under Strickland, there is a presumption of adequacy that doesn't exist in Geist.
I'm struggling with the fact that even with effective assistance of counsel in this case, given the facts and circumstances of the plan, of the parents, and for now I'll at least use those terms, both parents, their failure to comply with the case plan, how, and not through lack of notice, not through lack of being present in court, but for failing to do their drug counseling, for failing to visit in the dad's instance, how do we get around the reality of the test that says it was found by the district court that it's in the best interest of this child to terminate these parental rights?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the facts in this case demonstrate, I think that at least in, probably in both cases, there were two termination proceedings here. And much of the failure to comply with the case plan, et cetera, came from failure in drug tests, at least on Jessica's part, mom's part, prior to that March 2012 denial of termination. Because post that, there was one positive test. It was an anomaly. It was for drugs that had never tested positive before. That those things had all, it was something that came up dirty for benzodiazepines, tranquilizers, if you will, and a week later were gone. So it's anomalous, but and no focus on that from that termination, the wake-up call, if you will, of March 2012, she got clean. She missed some tests, that's true. But
tested positive a couple times for coke and other drugs.
Not post 2012. I think there was one, if I'm not mistaken, that was in March. It was like the immediate right after the trial or after the denial order. And then after that, I believe it was the one benzodiazepine after that. She did miss some. She had done well enough for the plan to switch to reunification.
Well, let me ask you this. And I could just correct me if I'm not right. The child was removed in 2009.
Correct.
And there's a presumption under 128.109.2 that if the child is out of the home for 14 out of the 20 consecutive month period, it's presumed that termination serves the best interest of the child.
Correct.
Even though the judge didn't specifically, I'm unclear on that point, whether the judge particularly considered that presumption under that statute.
I believe she did, Your Honor. It was part of her findings.
Well, he didn't really go after him in terms of the presumption about out of the home, but there was some findings in the record, at least testimony on the record, specifically as to on visitation of the child because the mother had done well early on, and then toward the end, the mother basically stopped coming to visit the child on days, and there was some, I'll call it damning statements in the record from the foster parent in terms of the child, the best interest of the child, because the child just kind of took the position mom didn't want to see him anymore.
Well, if I'm not mistaken,
and the court kind of considered that in making their finding.
I understand that, Your Honor, and what I believe is that she didn't miss weeks in a row. It was she would go, then she would miss a week, and then she'd go, and she'd miss a couple weeks.
The record's pretty clear in terms of the beginning. She was regular, fairly regular. But then as we got out there, basically she wasn't coming the kid, I'll just say copped an attitude properly, but copped an attitude about mom's not coming. Mom doesn't care.
And what happens is then we have one person making a decision, Your Honor, that if a child resigns himself to something that doesn't appear to be happening, because on the one hand we have, I'm trying to do this, we're going to get there, and so the child gets mad, and then if he changes his attitude or he behaves differently, we hold it against them. If the mother is trying to do, and shows up for therapy with the child and then is told to do something else and gets upset about that, then we hold it against her. This is the problem with an amorphous plan. And I truly believe that these plans are amorphous and they are not clear and well-defined as to what a parent must do for reunification.
The plan, counsel, the plans seem to be very well-defined. You're talking about a couple of things in addition that related to the plan that she was asked to do. She was present at the time, so it's hard to say that she didn't receive notice of being asked to do those additional things.
And she testified, number one, for example, the mental health screening, she testified that she did it. They testified they couldn't find it. This goes back to, again, if you look, and I believe even under Matthews v. Eldridge, ineffective assistance of counsel would apply here, that should have been something that was, that the counsel was prepared for and it brought evidence in and didn't do that, didn't cite evidence about the benzodiazepine test, didn't object to much of the evidence that was used was hearsay as to what the child was saying, what she had said to the child. We have his mental health being evaluated by an intern with no sign-off in the record anywhere by a supervisor. So we don't even know if this person was qualified to make comments on Dajay's behavior and what it actually meant. And these are the problems that are in this record. We have no objections to any of that, and evidence that should never have been admitted into the record being admitted. So under those circumstances and the fact that the possibility of a mistaken outcome based on, remember we're looking at, she had criminal charges against her, it was drug, we admit that the facts aren't great. The facts are bad. I would admit that. But I think that what we have is a problem where counsel did very little to help his client in this case. And again, where there's nothing in the record to say why she shouldn't have had counsel, we would ask that this court presume it's because these proceedings, which are akin to civil death penalties, that the court is concerned about possible due process. I'd like to leave time for Mr. George, if that's possible.
I'll ask you one more question before you sit down. These are terribly tough cases for everybody.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the goals is establishing permanency for the child. And in this case, it seems like she's been in foster care. He's been in foster care for a long period of time. It's a tough case. How do you argue that? That she had many, many chances. She passed a couple of drug tests that she failed a whole bunch of over this period of time.
And again, Your Honor, I would ask you to look at the drug tests after 2012, because to hold the things that happened before when she finally cleans up and then hold those against her, I would ask you not to look at that. The time is an issue. But this is the person who was only given, at most, an hour of time at a time to be able to spend with her child.
When
they
she
want to spend
up,
together.
You know, she blew off a lot of the visitations.
And, Your Honor, when we put the problems on parents, when the state has taken custody of a child, we expect more than we expected regular parents out there who make a decision between going to work and not going to work, seeing their child or not seeing their child, using a babysitter or not using a babysitter. And we expect such strict compliance, even though it's so substantial. Everything that a parent doesn't do is held against them versus the parents who are out there that are allowed to keep their child and should be allowed to keep their children because because everybody deals with the stresses of life on a daily basis. I would just ask this Court to take that into consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. George, I'll give you some additional time so you can make the argument appropriate on behalf of your client. You'll have 5 minutes.
Sir, I'm going to start you with the tough question. What in the world in this record points us to suggesting that your client should have the right to parent?
You know, I was prepared. I had obviously prepared something to say in front of the Court today, and I'd like to respond to your question to Ms. Gilbert regarding the best interest of the child. I had prepared some examples of the ineffective assistance of counsel regarding my client, but one thing that counsel did for my client was, in his closing argument, identified that the best interest of the child hadn't been addressed during the trial, that the trial was more about the parents' inadequacies, and he referred in his closing argument to that being the issue that was left
undecided. Well, that's part of the test.
So
parental fault is part of the test, right?
Correct.
Okay, so we got to get past that before we start balancing anything else, right? As in best interest?
I think that they're mutually inclusive. I don't think you necessarily have to get past the one. I think that the best interest of the child are fundamentally involve the biological parents being the parent for that child. I think that that's fundamental and primary.
So what in this record gives your client the right to parent this child?
My client, his circumstances were a little unique because he was incarcerated throughout the determination, the time when his parental rights were being destined. I don't think that he had a whole lot of opportunity to have any input.
And an opportunity to make phone calls, didn't he?
I think he had the opportunity to make phone calls, but
he exercised his right to be able to make those phone calls.
He was relying, I think, on counsel, and his counsel didn't communicate with him at all while he was incarcerated, as far as I can tell from the record.
How about writing letters?
Yeah. I guess I don't know of any letters being written by my client. I would agree that my client could have made, you know, more strenuous efforts to communicate with his child. I do think that being incarcerated is a pretty extreme circumstance. I also think that his counsel did not make any efforts to provide him any representation while he was incarcerated and on behalf of his interest as a parent.
You know, what's curious to me, counsel, is this. In May of 2012, against a record which shows a number of problems with your client's contact with the child and poor interaction with the child and the like, the district court rejected the termination of your client's parental rights and said, no, I'm going to maintain them.
Correct.
So it isn't until after the second petition, then, that I think we should look at his conduct. And after the second petition, and after he prevails on the first petition, the contact seems to get worse in terms of communication with the child. Was there a reason for that? I mean, the second petition was filed in May of 2012. He doesn't visit with the child. He or participate in substance abuse counseling. He is out of state. It seems like the communication gets even less after he's already won the first petition.
Right.
What was the reason for that change?
I can't answer that question.
I mean, he wasn't incarcerated then. In fact, he's on probation. He's in a halfway house in May through December of 2013. So I just wonder what your argument is as to the second petition.
I can't answer as to why he didn't increase his contact with his child after that.
Okay. All right.
To right to counsel and effective assistant counsel, what would you offer different from what Ms. Gilbert has offered?
Well, I would say in regards to my client in this matter, regardless of the presumption, I think he had a right to counsel. One of the points that I wanted to make,
But why?
Because I think there's a fundamental right to being a parent that's at stake here. I think that that's a right that should be protected.
So after the second petition, you would argue he should have had counsel appointed for him?
I think he did have counsel appointed for him at that point during the second petition. I don't think counsel was effective.
I guess that's what I was trying to draw out. In what way was counsel not effective in representing a client who was invisible?
Right.
I mean, and not incarcerated, at least for most of the time. What is the ineffectiveness? Assuming that we recognize that potential claim, in what respect was counsel ineffective in the second petition?
I understand your question. I think it was ineffective because I think it's become upon counsel to make an effort to involve the client in whatever matter the attorney is representing the client, you know, and I don't think that happened here. I mean, I have some citations to the record, what I think are egregious examples of ineffective assistance of counsel. But one of the points I want to
make. Give me your best shot after the second petition.
Okay. There was a no contact order between my client and Ms. Gilbert's client. And I think given the fact they both had parental plans, it was impossible for my client to correspond or to coordinate with Ms. Gilbert's client in an effort to parent Dajay. I think that's fundamentally one of the worst examples of ineffective assistance.
But the parenting seemed to go to, as you're categorizing it, as to doing things within the case plan and visiting the child, and the record is basically replete with silence as to making efforts toward those things.
Same question that I asked Ms. Gilbert. What is it that effective counsel was supposed to do in this instance? Save and accept, take mom or dad, in this case, by the hand and engage them in visitation with the child?
Okay, I think the answer to that is fundamentally different because of the different circumstances.
Recognizing the incarceration, et cetera, so I get that. But you know, participation in programming, you know, all of that. I don't know how counsel can make that happen.
I think through communication with this client, a counsel should be able to make that happen. I mean, clients can be mismanageable or unmanageable, but I think in a circumstance where you are representing somebody and something as important and primal as their parenting, I think if it requires a little extra effort on the part of counsel, then that's the way it should be.
Were you expecting counsel to assault and batter the client to get them to do something?
No, I don't think it requires assault and battery, but I do think that making an extra effort to involve your client in whatever matter you're representing your client in is necessary and required, and I don't think those efforts were made on this record.
What should competent counsel do in the example you cited where there is a no-contact order between the parents?
I think that's a pretty simple. There was a simple solution to that. I think that counsel had the facilities and resources to make a modification in that.
To the no contact order.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Any other questions for counsel? All right. Anything else you wanted to add before you wrap up?
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument. Okay, Ms. Calderon.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Hardesty and all the justices. May it please the court, my name is Christina Calderon. I'm Deputy District Attorney representing the Department of Family Services in this case. The district court in this case properly found that termination of parental rights was warranted. As the court is aware, termination of parental rights, a party petitioning to terminate parental rights must establish by clear and convincing evidence both that the termination was in the child's best interest and that parental fault exists. I believe the justices have recognized that this was a difficult case involving, at the time of trial, a 7-year-old child who had been in foster care for over 4 years. Specifically, the minor child was in care for 51 months, during which, over the course of which, both parents failed to comply with their case plans, failed to exhibit behavioral change, and the minor child was exhibiting severe reaction to being in foster care for such a lengthy period of time and not having the permanency and stability that the Nevada legislature and federal guidelines require the state to seek for children in this position.
And in fact, isn't the state under an obligation to do so, notwithstanding that there were two petitions in this case, much sooner than 51 months?
Yes, Justice Seda, you're correct. The second petition that was filed in this case, there was some discussion with Ms. Gilbert regarding the circumstances involving her client. Her client did test positive for cocaine following the first trial in this case. And the she was also discharged from substance abuse treatment program. And following the trial, the natural father also acknowledged in writing that he was addicted to substances and had ingested cocaine. So the state, even though we did not prevail in the first petition, looked to reunification possibilities, as we are required to do in all cases, and were unable to reunify the subject minor with his children, with his parents, following the petition. The second petition was filed because 2 years had already transpired in the case, and the minor was lacking the permanency and stability that he deserved.
Now, for 5 years, the child was placed with the same foster parent.
Unfortunately, no.
No.
No. He went through several foster homes. The foster parent who testified at trial had not had him for that long, but had made the greatest strides in terms of addressing his behaviors.
And this is the one that wanted to adopt him?
He did not. She was not an adoptive resource.
Okay. Who was the adoptive resource?
At the time of trial, there was no adoptive resource. There was testimony from the Department of Family Services Adoption Unit regarding the possibility of the minor being placed in different homes and the efforts that the department had undertaken to get him adopted.
Is there anything good that DFS could say about the representation of these two parents? In other words, did the lawyers do anything good as far as you were concerned as a counsel?
Both parents were represented by very experienced counsel in this field. The mother was represented by the same attorney since 2009 through the trial.
Through the second trial?
Through the second trial. As Mr. George indicated, even in the closing arguments supporting his client's case, he made, I believe Mr. George was indicating that he made some good arguments regarding best interests. Ms. Gilbert indicates that one of the factual basis upon which she claims ineffective assistance of counsel is that the mother's counsel didn't provide proof that the natural mother had gone to a psychiatric assessment. But that's assuming that she, in fact, went.
Counsel, as to that point, because it keeps coming up, popping up, the department tends to modify case plans without putting them in writing. We have a case plan that's been approved by the district court judge, and then they make oral pronouncements that they want the parent to do something additional. I'm not saying they can't ask them to do it, but it's very seldom in writing. Why is that happen so that we get into the situation of someone saying I didn't have adequate notice.
Justice Douglas, to answer your question, in this particular case, it was in writing. The requirement of the natural mother was to address her substance abuse and to follow any and all recommendations of that provider. In many of the cases that are in this
as psychiatric realm, as some other things, that was asked, because it seems to be, the statute seems to be clear that you have to have a case plan agreed to by the court. And then as we get into this, we start seeing all these additions, and no one ever goes back into court. I know in one of the orders it was done in open court, but still, why could it have been in writing?
Justice
would make
Douglas,
things so easy on the backside.
And to answer your question, mental health and substance abuse is often interrelated. If the natural mother in this case wasn't...
they could have ordered that up front when they made the case plan if it's so fundamental as you're making it out this day.
If the natural mother was candid regarding her mental health issues, she didn't disclose mental health issues until 2012 when she told Vitality, I'm depressed, I have bipolar, and I have ADHD. At which point, the substance abuse counselor who was assessing her recommended her to get an assessment for her mental health. If we knew, we didn't know those circumstances at the beginning of the case because the natural mother wasn't candid.
But how difficult, based on the length of this case, would it have been for the department to go back in and ask for the court to bless the modification?
Well, the court did tell the natural mother at repeated hearings to follow through.
Then why wasn't that incorporated into the actual written plan? You know, we're talking about termination of rights. This is an extreme case on the one side, but this is a recurring situation of something happens and the worker says, I want you to do something else. And it's never memorialized.
Well, there is the very recent Supreme Court case in Re APM that indicates that termination of parental rights can occur notwithstanding completion of a case plan.
Yes, and we have differing views on, quote, the case plan, because in some cases we've had completions, and for some reason the department has still gone forward, which seems to be very inappropriate, but that's just my statement.
But I believe that the focus on a case plan versus the behaviors is not in the best interest of the child. So if we as the state only focus on a form and checking boxes, then we disregard well-settled case law that says even if you complete your case plan but you're not addressing your behaviors, then
But you're not addressing your behavior, and the case plan never made that part of the case plan. That's the difficulty.
But it was part of this case plan to the extent that it said follow recommendations, and when you go to review hearings, and specifically in this case, the court told the mother, follow the recommendation, go get your mental health assessment if you want your child returned to you. She was on notice. She was represented by counsel at repeated hearings. Specifically in May 2013 when she was told, we're going to ask for 90 days to reunify you with your child. Follow through with your mental health. And then she lost contact with the department. Her excuse was that her grandfather had passed away. She tested positive in June. And the child, the child was suffering during this period of time. There was indications in the record and from the testimony of various witnesses that the child was having negative reactions with the mother, especially at visitation, and that was witnessed by the foster mother who testified. So I don't think that this mother lacked due process in the sense that she knew what was required of her. It wasn't as if a new requirement out of the blue came to her attention that she should address mental health.
In the state of Nevada, should, as they're asking for, should there be, quote, a right to counsel, and there should there be an effective right to counsel?
I don't see the need to overturn a well-established case law in this matter, in Re NDO, which was decided in 2005. It followed the United States Supreme Court decision of Lassiter, and they and they did the balancing test with Matthews v. Eldridge. The Nevada legislature has spoken in terms of NRS 128-100 in the sense that the Nevada legislature envisions a case-by-case determination on the right to counsel. The presumption that Ms. Gilbert is advocating, I think, should possibly even maybe be the reverse. If there's no language or wording in the decision, why do we not have the presumption that a due process right to counsel was not required in that case?
Counsel, do you have any persuasive authority from other jurisdictions that assigns a right to counsel for terminations?
Do I have any? No, I do not. Other than the Oregon decision cited by Ms. Gilbert, but
thank you.
What about the parental fault on behalf of the father?
Parental fault was well established by the father. Mr. George's argument that he was incarcerated and unable to communicate with his child, it's not persuasive to the extent that the natural father was only incarcerated from approximately December of 2012 to October 2013.
How long was the no contact order in place?
There's no contact order, I believe.
Because that disturbs me a little bit. How's the father supposed to make contact with the child if there's a non-contact order in place, I assume, with mom?
I'm not sure where Mr. George is referring to that no-contact order. I believe it's through the criminal court, and it's between the natural father and the natural mother. That there wasn't a no-contact order in our case prohibiting contact between the child and the parents.
No, but necessarily, in order to talk to the child, you'd have to call the mom.
The mom didn't have custody. The state had custody of the child for 4 years.
So
the parents didn't have to interact with each other.
They didn't have to have
they
any
had
contact.
Separate identical case plans that they could address the matters independently.
So the no-contact order is
irrelevant.
Irrelevant.
There was no order that they co-parent because the child wasn't in either of their care or custody.
Okay.
What else did the father do besides the not be in contact with the child?
He didn't provide, he did not successfully complete any substance abuse treatment program. This predated the first TPR, but he did an assessment and then didn't come back for the second part of that assessment to get recommendations. And then following the first TPR, he tested positive multiple times, having his probation revoked and resulting in his incarceration.
Aside from drug abuse, do we have anything else that, I know that's a big deal too, but if we start taking kids away from every addicted parent, we're going to have to open up orphan's homes again.
He had an extensive criminal history that he testified to on the stand. There were judgments of convictions, felony convictions, substance related in our state, but he had a significant criminal history, including he was affiliated with gangs, and that was part of one of his conditions in his judgment of conviction, indicated that he was to not have any gang involvement. He also had no stable residence. He never communicated to the department where he actually was living. We couldn't yet assess safety in terms of reunifying the child because he would say, no, I'm in California. Don't even bother setting up a visitation schedule for me because I'm not in the state. In terms of his visitation with the child, which predated the first TPR, he would go to the visitation center and not interact with the child. So the bond with the child wasn't there during the limited time that he had with him.
Well, I would imagine the issue, the fact that the child was removed primarily because of drugs and drugs being within reach of the child had something to do with the focus on the drugs use in this case.
Yes, yes, Justice Perigary, yes. And also the fact that a SWAT team had to go into the apartment because of they were looking for, and that's also in the record, guns and drugs.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Calderon, for your argument today, counsel. Thank you for your arguments. We appreciate your input. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess.